This episode was recorded a couple of months back, so that's why when we're talking about the election, we're not referring to more current events. That said, I think that pretty much everything that's said about the election is pretty prescient. Also, it was recorded in a cafe, but regardless of the background sound, I think this is a great conversation.
It's the second most expensive street in Britain, and when you walk down it, there are absolutely, I'd say about 60 to 70% of the mansions there are abandoned. Some of them are completely overgrown. You can see like trees growing out of the chimney. The gates are almost hanging off.
Hello, I'm Dave. I'm the guy that's putting all this stuff together.
I need to get better. Please make me better. I want to get better. Better. Better acquainted with you.
Today we're getting better acquainted with Dawn. Hello, Dawn.
Hello.
So the first question that I ask everybody is, how do you know me?
I suppose I know you in two ways. So the first is just through the internet, so via Twitter and that sort of thing, and you're friends with quite a few of my friends, like Martin and Helen, who do a lot of podcasting. I met you for the first time at the Focus E15 occupation.
That's right.
In Stratford. And it's always very awkward when you meet people off the internet for the first time, when you have that thing where you're like, is it them? And then once you realise it is, you go on to the next bit, which is, should I say hello?
Right.
And so I was glad you did, and it was good.
Yeah, it was definitely a surreal moment for me, because it was like, you were there with another person I know from Twitter as well, and I was trying to work out if it seemed too much of a coincidence for two people I know, even though I knew that you knew each other. Yeah, it was nerve-wracking to ask, because you never know what people are going to be like. I'm not always a very social person walking through the world as well, so like sometimes I really like it when people talk to me, and sometimes I don't, so I'm always
hyper-aware. I think it's one of those new kind of social spaces we haven't quite navigated yet, so I mean, like, it's pretty straightforward to agree to meet somebody at a bar, go along and say, you know, hello, etc.
Yeah.
And how to meet people at parties and that sort of thing. But when you kind of feel as though you know somebody quite a bit off online, right, and you see them offline, and it's still quite nerve-wracking. So, I mean, like, I've had people come up to me and say, Dawn, hello, that sort of thing, that's fine. But at the same time, I've had a few instances where somebody has tweeted, ha ha ha, just saw Dawn on a bus reading a book.
Yeah.
And I find that really unnerving. I'd much rather people just said hello.
Yeah.
But it's a bit odd knowing that you were sat on the bus reading, somebody saw you and decided to share it with the world rather than say hello.
I get that. I have a horrible feeling, not to you, but I think when I first came on Twitter, I think I occasionally did that kind of a tweet of like, oh, just because I was excited to see people. And then I think, I remember I was at the Story conference, I think, and I tweeted something like, oh wow, Laurie Penny's here, right? Mm. Then she replied to it, and I was like, suddenly like, oh right, okay, of course. And I'm definitely not going to go and speak to her, because I now feel too nervous about the whole thing. So I think that's when I sort of like stopped shouting people out on Twitter. The other time we sort of, because we've not sat down and had a conversation,
no.
This is kind of the first time we've done that. But the other time we have sort of been in the same space was, we both did Geek Show Off. We were on the same lineup for that. And that was another sort of awkward. I'm very socially awkward about these things. So I remember, like, afterwards, I was sort of like, you and Alice,
Juliet Jakes.
There we go.
Yeah,
we're sitting in together inside, and I know Alice. I've talked to Alice, and I was sort of like, but you and Juliet together. I'm kind of in awe of both of you separately. So it was like, I didn't want to sort of like go over and say hello. So yeah. But anyway, that's the history of my social awkwardness around you. Yeah, I am a little bit, I can sense it already, I'm a little bit nervous. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Talking to you, because I do respect you, but I guess that's a weird thing that you kind of, I remember
if you hated me, would it be easier?
Yeah. I think so, yeah, probably. Well, also, it's like one of those things as well, like, I think you said something on social media about this recently, about like, you've got like almost a slight reputation of like being quite like
I've had this weird thing where like a few people I know for a little while now have said that when they first met me, they were quite intimidated to meet me. I don't know if they were scared of me or my reputation preceded me or something, but one of them, it was just a really, really, it was slightly flattering but a bit unnerving. So one this woman I know now said that I'd met her a few times, I invited her to my birthday party, and she said she had stage fright coming to my birthday for some reason. I never kind of considered myself a particularly intimidating person.
No.
But
I mean, occasionally people have occasionally called me intimidating, which always confuses me as well.
Is that because of the baseball bat you're carrying around with you right now?
Right, exactly. I think with you probably it's because you're, first of all, like, you're very political, like, you've got good politics, and so everyone's always a bit nervous around saying, well, we're good politics, and they're going to prove to have bad politics by accident and then get sort of stuck. Also, I guess it's, you're very good at, like, making cutting comments that I fully support about men, and I am obviously a man, so it always makes me a bit nervous talking
mostly
to people
male
who,
politicians
yeah, yeah sure
figures,
sure sorry. I mean, men as a group, yeah, as a concept, not as an individuals, and you know, quite jokingly as well, but it is always like, yeah, I'm just a very awkward person around anybody that I can potentially say the wrong thing in front of. So no doubt I'll say many wrong things. So the second question that I ask everybody is, what do you do now?
I'm now a freelance journalist, so I'm fully freelance. I used to work at The Guardian on comment, and I did lots of writing for Society. Then I went to a housing magazine, Inside Housing, for about 9 months when I covered somebody's maternity. And then they cut a few jobs, and mine was one of them. And I just decided to go freelance completely. And it was really, really terrifying at first. I had this image of just, you know, becoming homeless while writing about housing.
Right.
But it's actually worked out really, really well. I'm really, really busy. I've got more work than I can imagine. So, I mean, I've written a few articles this week. I'm chairing an event tomorrow. And I was on Sky News this morning talking about PMQs.
Right. And kind of frequently on Sky News.
Yeah, it's good fun. I've got bright orange makeup on that luckily the podcast listeners can't see. So it's going pretty well. I'm surprised at how well it started, and I'm getting busier, so it's nice. I can set my own hours, like seeing more of my friends because I can pop and see them for lunch and that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a sort of like the look on your face that I have a little bit often, because I went freelance last year, and it's kind of like surprised that things are going well.
Yeah.
That's definitely how I felt for the first 6 months, although I have to say this year so far I've not really done so well, but the first 6 months went wicked, so
yeah.
I'm sure that's just part of the whole process. And I had a similar sort of thing as well, that my job got kind of cut. It was a different, it was a day job rather than the kind of job I want. But
yeah,
it was cut. And then yeah, you sort of have to make this decision about whether to jump or where is it the right time?
Yeah.
You know, and clearly it sounds like it is the right time for you.
It's good. It's helpful. Good. I think also going freelance a few months before an election is a really good move, because everybody wants people to talk about the election and politics, and it's a good position to be in, I think.
Right, and you're not affiliated to anyone as well, so you can kind of go into any sort of space for that. And, like,
I'm not a party member. Right. I'm critical of all parties. I mean, I find it quite strange how, even though I'm probably most critical of the Tories and Labour, probably, the most abuse I get for criticism is when I criticise the Greens. And I feel more warmth towards the Greens than any other party, but the Green Party supporters seem to be like particularly vociferous. Any mild criticism is just met with a torrent of kind of abuse. It's really, really strange. Tories just couldn't care less, pretty much.
Right.
I've got Tory councillors who follow me on Twitter and retweet things I say that are clearly quite critical of Cameron, but it doesn't work that way for the Greens.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because they've just got a lot longer of a road to go, so like any obstacles in the way they sort of like see as damaging, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm in a similar position of like, I'm the warmest about the Greens out of all of the parties.
Yeah.
But I mean, I find it hard to get behind any of the parties because I just see that the whole damn system has been so flawed.
Completely.
Like, where the hell, like, you know, whoever you support, it's still the same system. So I can't see that working so well. But we'll see. I try to be pragmatic, and I definitely prefer a non-Tory government.
Yes, definitely. I think it's going to be a terrible, terrible election, though. I thought 2010 was terrible, but I think this is going to be even worse. Nobody's sure who's going to come out top. I think it's just going to be quite puerile a lot of the time. It's going to be a really, really dirty election. I think it's going to be really, really close. I think we might even, I mean, I don't know how it works with fixed term parliaments, but I think we might even get to the point where nobody can form a government and it will be a minority government. Like, the only viable thing really, I suppose, is Labour and the SNP, and Labour won't go in with the SNP, so that's it.
Yeah, I mean, although my biggest fear is a Tory UKIP coalition, just because of the fact that that seems to me to be that will just give the Tories an opportunity to just take to just do anything they want, because
I generally don't think UKIP will get enough MPs. So
they haven't
so far. All they've managed to get is Tories re-elected under a different rosette.
Right.
So I think I'd be surprised if they picked up more than two more seats max.
Good. I mean, you're much more knowledgeable about these things than me.
I don't see the numbers happening. Good. I did a few months ago, but I think the wheels are coming off the UKIP train a little bit.
Good.
But I think we'll see a lot of Lib Dems go.
Yeah.
A lot of them are even in cabinet. Also, I mean, I think a lot of Tories will lose their seats as well. So, I mean, like, I wouldn't be surprised if Clegg lost his seat. I wouldn't be surprised if Nicky Morgan, the Education Secretary, lost her seat. I think there'll be a lot of scalps disappearing, so that'll be interesting to see. And I think they might lose a few seats in Wales as well, and Labour will lose a lot in Scotland, which is really, really fascinating. But I think it's going to be a really dirty tricks election. I think almost 1 million people dropped off the electoral register because of the way they changed it. If we're going to have an election that increases apathy, and then a lot of people who just can't vote because they've been dropped off the register, so right. It's going to be great.
Well, I mean, at least it's going to be an interesting election for you to cover. From a personal point of view, that's probably better than it being really boring.
Yeah.
So, but from a political and social point of view, not so much. Right. I know that you are from Wales. I can't say I'm from Wales because I was born in England, so I've moved about between England and Wales. But I lived in Cardiff from 12 to 18.
Yeah.
So that's where I kind of was an adolescent. So I feel like
Cardiff's a great city. I really love Cardiff. I'm from Newport, which is the nearest city to it. And I suppose cities in Wales basically go, in terms of size, Cardiff, Swansea, Newport.
Right.
Newport was quite an interesting place to grow up. It was really, really down at heel, basically. So obviously you had the mines, and the valleys was quite thriving, and the mines slowly closed. And Newport had a big steelworks, and then when I was still at school, the steelworks closed. So you saw a lot of people who worked in the mines, lost their jobs there, moved to the steelworks, continued with a profession, and then all the people lost their jobs at the same time. And then we had several big Woolworths shops as well, and they all went bust. And you just very, very quickly saw any kind of economic progress the city had made just going a complete reverse. And then the recession hit. And it hit Newport particularly hard. I mean, if you look at South Wales, it's one of the areas that's hardest hit.
Right,
it's
absolutely.
Hardest hit by the bedroom tax. It's been hardest hit by cuts and job losses. It's increasingly a place that young people leave. I spoke to a friend of mine who does human geography, and he points out that the problem with a lot of these kind of post-industrial cities is that anybody who is smart and can do well in life doesn't do so there. They move to London or Manchester, big cities. And so you have, even on a small geographic level, you have, a bit of a brain drain going on.
Right.
And that's happened a lot in South Wales. There's been a huge exodus of people. People go to university and never go back to Wales.
That's interesting. I mean, it's funny because a lot of the people, I always used to think, growing up, a lot of the people who went to university from my contemporaries were going to Aberystwyth,
same here.
Or to Cardiff,
So
there was definitely a sense of wanting to stay in Wales from a lot of those people.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess even when they graduate from Welsh universities, then they go somewhere else because they have to do with their skills in Wales.
I don't have much contact with people I went to school with, but the ones that I do are people I've bumped into in London.
Right.
So a handful of people, there weren't that many, a handful of people who went to universities, full stop, not many of them at all, went to universities outside of Wales. So Welsh universities have a tendency to let people in if you're Welsh, and it's the same as Scotland, basically. And so Welsh people applying to English universities often don't get in. I went off to Warwick, and as soon as I finished, I just decided to go to London. I always wanted to live in London. I knew I had a much better chance of a job there.
So went to uni in Warwick. So before I was in Cardiff, I was in Coventry.
Oh.
So that's interesting. There's a couple of locational connections there.
I lived in Coventry. So if you go to Warwick University, you either live in Leamington Spa or you live in Coventry.
Right.
And there seems to be a really big subject and class divide. So.
Yes.
if you're studying maths or a science or you're working class, you end up in Coventry because it's cheaper and it's closer to the campus, and all the art students, all the well-to-do people, all the postgrads all ended up in Leamington.
Right.
So I lived in Coventry the entire time I was there. I found it fine, especially in comparison to Newport, whereas I guess if you came from a more picturesque place, then you might find Coventry a bit off-putting, but
well, Leamington Spa was definitely within, growing up in Coventry, that was a posh place.
Yeah, like, yeah. And then occasionally you had people who were so posh they lived in Kenilworth.
Right.
Maybe 10 every year.
Right. I mean, whereas Coventry's quite, I mean, you know, it's got lots of different classes, as most cities do, yeah. But it is, you know, there's a lot of really solidly working class areas.
Yeah, and it's still quite post-industrial. You had a very, very big car factory. Even when I was at university, I think Question Time came to campus and a lot of people from Coventry were there to talk about the fact that, I think it was a Rover plant. Rover had announced that they were going to cut all the jobs there.
Right.
And that was the biggest concern for the people there. They'd already lost a lot of jobs. I mean, like, a lot of cars were made around the outskirts of Oxford, around Coventry, in the Midlands and the top of the South East, I suppose. And it was, yeah, because I was at university when the recession happened and it was just after the crash. Rover had said that they were going to move production from Coventry out to Germany, I think. And it was a really big concern. There were still a lot of working class people who'd worked in the car factory all their life and their dads had done that before them, so...
Yeah, and it's what happens to communities when the industries go. Like, obviously that's what has gone all the way through the Welsh valleys, but it's also that's what's happening in Coventry and all of these kind of cities. I guess going to university during a recession is a sort of interesting time to go to university because, like, it doesn't feel as hopeful as, like, university is supposed to feel.
I mean, everyone I know went to university. Some of them did it just because it was a done thing. Most of us did it because we thought we'd get a better job afterwards, you know. I looked at jobs I could get for, say, in Newport, and if I was lucky, I'd be a receptionist. And I thought, no, I'm going to go to university. I had a really good teacher who told me to. And it was just really, really strange. I mean, I started university in 2005, and I just remember 2008, suddenly seeing things happening very slowly on the news, you know, lots of warnings, and then Lehman Brothers crashed, and I just remember everybody in university saying, what does this mean? This is big, I need to understand why it's big. And then just quite quickly realising with, like, the whole crash that actually we were in a lot of trouble. When I started university, there were lots and lots of careers fairs advertising quite plush graduate jobs with good starting salaries, and you just saw them dry up very, very quickly. And everybody just getting quite worried about what this meant for employment and that sort of thing. And then I think the biggest shock was when Northern Rock got into trouble and you saw lines of people outside the bank. I'd never seen that before outside of, like, Mary Poppins. And you suddenly began to realise that we were in a lot of trouble. And I think at the time politicians kept saying, oh, it'll only be a year, it'll be fine. And I think quite quickly everybody realised it was going to be a long, long thing and would probably affect us for a long time.
Did you go straight to university from school? Or did you have
You
did?
I worked during summer and holidays for a Labour MP for a little bit, doing some policy and research. Whenever I came back, I'd do a bit of that. And that was really, really interesting. She was a newly elected MP, so I did some research on, like, we had a big-ish Afghan refugee population in Newport, so I did some research on that, and it was really interesting to do when you're quite young.
Right.
But I did English at university, not politics, but it was good.
So you were already sort of going towards sort of, like, journalistic, political topics?
I think I was always quite political. I didn't really think about journalism as a job until quite a lot later. It all kind of happened quite accidentally. So after university, I did some work in education, so I was working at University of East London doing student advice. I was a governor at a primary school as well, so I was dealing with a lot of people's social problems, social issues, and I was really quite passionate about inequality and that sort of thing. Started a blog about cycling that became really, really popular very quickly, and The Guardian asked me to write articles off the back of that. And then when I saw a job on the Comet desk there, I applied for it, got it, and I stayed there for a few years. So that was how I got into journalism within about 2 years of leaving university, but it was a complete accident.
Right. So you went to university in 2005, you said, right?
And I did a BA and a master's.
Now I'm even more intimidated because I'm now working out that you're younger than me. I think you're younger. I went to university in 2000, so I was out in 2003.
Yeah.
It sounds like I'm talking about prison, but you've got to where you are relatively quickly, which is, I guess, a surprise.
Yeah, it is. I was surprised. I was surprised the first time The Guardian asked me to write for them. I was just messing around with a silly little cycling blog where I basically, every time, I got a lot of kind of harassment. So a lot of men would shout stupid inane comments at me when I was cycling. And I'd mention it to friends in the pub and they'd always be quite fascinated. The men would be really surprised at it and the women would say, oh God, yes, it happened to me as well. So I started a blog where I wrote down a kind of jokingly, slightly sarcastic, like, count of what happened and plotted each incident on a Google map to see if there were clusters of places where people were horrible to female cyclists and things like that. Wow. And it became like really weirdly popular very, very quickly.
Did you find that there were clusters, or what did you
sometimes find? I mean, it wasn't kind of scientifically sound because most of it followed my commute and places I went in London. I found there were stretches of the Walworth Road where it was fine, stretches where without fail if I stopped at traffic lights and there was a man nearby they would feel the need to comment. I found some of the worst stuff was in very, very posh areas. Right. So men, you know, drunk men in red trousers, you know, trying to grab my handlebars and that sort of thing. A lot of it was just about entitlement. And so if I cycled through Chelsea, you'd get quite a bit of it, which is quite strange. But it was all sorts of ages. It wasn't just young men, it was old men. There wasn't one kind of person. There wasn't one kind of community or place. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
And it was all very different. So
I mean, I guess they were all men. That's a unifying factor. Yeah, I mean, I'm never one to defend my gender, particularly not for street harassment. But yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's interesting from a point of view of a lot of people have ideas about street harassment being based along class lines.
And you've
disproved that by your experience.
It's not remotely.
I mean,
I think it's very strange. I think a lot of it is to do with entitlement, but some of it is also to do with the way the city is laid out, I think. So I lived in Catford a little while ago, and I got a lot of it there. And I realised that part of the reason why was because I would often be at work quite late. I did shifts at The Guardian. I'd be coming home on my own at about 11 p.m. And because Catford was maybe Zone 3, it was a lot quieter at night, so there was nobody else around. So I'd get like slightly more aggressive street harassment, people following me and that sort of thing. Whereas now I live in Brixton, which for the most part socioeconomically is very similar to Catford, but because it's busier and there are always people around, I don't get any harassment whatsoever. Right. There are always people around, and so people feel less comfortable in having a go at you, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I got knocked off my bike once, and my friend Andrea came with me to hospital, and we left hospital in, I think it was Kensington, quite late at night. I mean, I'd been knocked off my bike at about 5 p.m. We were out at the hospital by about 11, and the level of harassment we got walking down the King's Road, absolutely unbelievable. You know, it's not along class lines whatsoever. Like, often in extremely posh areas, I find it even worse because I suppose you have this kind of intrinsic arrogance that comes out in any way it can. So if you've had a few drinks and you're in Chelsea, there's no reason for, you know, to think that you won't shout at a woman going past you. It's nothing to do with manners or anything like that.
Right.
And I find it quite tiresome that that is seen as an argument.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was an American writer who I forgot the name of, who said, well, you know, street harassment only happens in ghetto neighbourhoods, which is not my experience, not the experience of anyone I know. So
I mean, it definitely doesn't seem to be the experience of anyone I know.
Yeah.
Street harassment obviously is something that now I find it hard to believe that people don't believe it still, because it's so out there now. It's like everyday sexism and stuff like that have opened it up a lot. But like as a man, you know, all I've got to go by is the information that my friends tell me and occasional moments of noticing.
Yeah.
When I'm in the world, I try to have my headphones on and not exist in a public space. So I guess I'm probably missing loads of stuff that's happening around me.
And there are two.
Isn't great.
Yeah, I mean, because quite often when people speak to me about it and say, or I see other people say that, dismiss it and say it doesn't exist, is their argument is normally, well, I've never seen it happen. And it's like, well, that's because you're not the target.
Exactly.
So either you're not noticing it, or more likely people do it when there's no one else around.
Right.
So most of the time when people are, you know, I mean, I don't even mean like wolf whistle, I mean like quite horrible kind of verbal harassment or, you know, groping, that sort of thing. There is nobody around. That someone is taking advantage of the fact that you are in a situation on your own. So there's no reason why bloke wandering around would see it, hear it, or even realise what was happening.
Although, actually, having said that, I mean, there have definitely been a couple of times when me and my partner, who's a woman, have been walking around when she, you know, when she's experienced harassment, like with me there in front of her. Although what happens is, as soon as they notice that there's a man there, they
apologize.
They apologize to me.
Exactly.
And I don't know how we can combat that problem without just telling men consistently it's not appropriate.
Yeah.
But then again, the other day I was just about to call someone out for sexual harassment when I discovered that he was talking to his partner and it was a
I think I think a lot of times that's why people don't intervene as well, because people always wonder, oh, is it a domestic? And I hate that phrase.
Well, if it was a domestic, I think that's appropriate to intervene to a certain extent. That moment was, it's, you know, I sort of heard this sort of phrase that would have been abusive if it hadn't have been a joke,
and then
I realised it was a joke.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a tricky one to work out how to get rid of, apart from, you know, just generally sort out men, which is something I'd like to do, but it's, you know, wouldn't be all.
It's really strange and insidious, and I don't have any answers. I always try to respond quite forcefully when it happens to me, or just laugh in their face. And then there's always a threat of violence, and obviously I'm like a relatively tall, articulate woman who could be quite physically menacing if I wanted to be, but a lot of my other friends just get genuinely very scared when it happens to them, which is understandable, because people can flip. And often when men harass me in the street and I just respond, they instantly flip into aggression.
Right.
I mean, it happened to me earlier. I was sat with a friend having a coffee. A bloke came up to us and said, oh, hi, I've got a CD, do you want to listen? And we said, no, sorry, we're having a conversation. And he went on and on and on, and then just started shouting at us, calling us all sorts of names, and then just barking, pretentious, pretentious. And then we left about 10 minutes later, and he'd been stood behind a pillar just watching us, and just kind of like laughed and then joking, and then started to follow us down into the tube, and we got genuinely like threatened at that point. But it's amazing how quickly someone flips from pretending to be like, you know, really nice, to just as the second you rebuff any of their advances, they're genuinely shocked that you have the audacity to do that.
Yeah.
And he just kept saying, like, everyone's entitled to your time, over and over again. And
what?
We just kept saying, no, they aren't, sorry. He needs to leave us alone, but, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
But there's always that danger.
And
there's that paper-thin line between slightly aggressive street harassment and then outright hostility and threat of violence.
Right.
So.
I mean, as a man, I'm afraid of men.
Yeah.
I'm afraid of male aggression. I've seen enough of it in my life. I know that it's a very scary thing for men, right? So I can, like, it must be so much scarier with everything else around it for women and for any gender to experience aggression from men is scary, but particularly ones that are not my gender. But yeah, it's interesting digression, and I'm trying to now steer myself to the subjects I was thinking of talking to you about. But I mean, it's a welcome digression. The more we speak about it, I guess.
Yeah.
The better. Are you the first person to go to university from your family?
Yeah, I was the first person to get any qualifications whatsoever.
Right.
So okay. I've got 2 degrees, I was first person to get A-levels, go to university, everything really.
Right.
So that was interesting. And I wouldn't be able to do it without a scholarship from Warwick. So Warwick gave me quite a good scholarship, and they gave me a job when I was there. And I was also the last year to come in before top-up fees. I genuinely think if top-up fees had come in, I probably wouldn't have gone to university.
Right.
I would have been genuinely freaked out by the level of debt and thought, well, what's the point of getting in that amount of debt when I can start earning immediately?
Right.
So
I got a little bit of help to go to university, but I'm from generally a middle class family. I mean, I've got my dad was retired, so I guess that's why. That's because it was just my mum's social work money. But still, like, even just that little extra and like inherited privilege from my class helped me get through university to a certain extent. But it is because you're involved in Arts Emergency. And you know, I'm a supporter of Arts Emergency as well. And I mean, it's definitely a very hard time to go to university if you don't have money now. But then it's kind of essential to go to university if you want to get any
completely.
Kind of a job now as well. So it's a bit shit.
I chaired a launch of a report into Meets Young People, not in education, employment or training. And it's just genuinely incredible. So David Blunkett was there, a couple of other kind of researchers and experts were talking about the findings and how the number of NEETs has strangely stayed the same, but the data's a bit off, so that they're not 100% certain. But just more and more people who are just stuck forever leaving school without qualifications or not having enough qualifications and then just never, ever, ever getting into work again. And they were all agreed that the Tory plan to force 18 to 21-year-olds to do community service in exchange for benefits was just pathetic. Partly because it reinforces the idea that young people don't want to work. All the research says that young people do want to work, but there aren't jobs there for them. And also that, I mean, nearly everybody's experienced it, where it's a lot easier to find a job when you have a job. First of all, it keeps your confidence up. You remember how to speak the language of business and employment and that sort of thing. But also, once you have to go to a interview and they say, well, can you explain the gaps in your employment? It's almost impossible to if you've never worked before. I remember when I was first looking for jobs when I was 14, it was quite difficult to get a job without experience, and it was difficult to get the experience in the first place in order to get the jobs, and you were just stuck in this catch-22 situation. My sister was stuck in it until quite recently as well, but in the end I got one break, and once I had one job it became a lot easier to get the others, and it's always been the same since. So I do worry a lot about people now who leave school without qualifications, because even to get I've seen adverts for jobs in Tesco, jobs in Asda, just on the till, and they all say you need C in English and maths, preferably A levels and that sort of thing. I mean, you have a lot of people who are really, really overqualified now going for lots of jobs, so people who would ordinarily have gone into, you know, pretty standard manual labour jobs, they're finding the jobs are drying up, and also because people are in general more educated, that it's becoming more difficult for them to get into work.
Right, and like a lot of where your writing goes towards is kind of jobs and housing, right? Those seem to be like that. Those kind of issues, I guess, are ones that obviously resonate, I guess, with you, which is why you want to cover them, but also they're the really pressing issues, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I worry a lot about how much the government simplify the economy. The government won't admit, really, that the economy is completely unbalanced, and so every time they say, oh, there's growth in the economy, it's tiny, it's less than 1%, and the growth is all in one or two places. It's all in the southeast. It's a little bit Manchester, maybe Birmingham, but if you look at other places, they're actually in a worse position than they are than before the recession. Northern Ireland is extraordinarily poor. South Wales and the North is so poor. And if you go down a lot of high streets in these places, I always find that the biggest indicator of the economy locally is walking down the high street. So if you walk down Newport High Street, if you walk down some high streets in Merseyside, you know, say Bradford High Street, that sort of thing, you see more and more empty shops. And it's kind of a metaphor for the local economy. So, for instance, in Newport, a lot of shops closed, and they weren't kind of shops that had gone bust. It was big shops that were doing well elsewhere, like Topshop, Marks and Spencer's. I even think a Greggs closed in Newport. And it's that rolling thing where a lot of people don't have jobs anymore, so they spend less, they have less money. Because they spend less, the shops close. And those people who are then employed have less money, and it just gets worse and worse and worse. And so I just find it irritating that a lot of people won't accept that the economy is getting sucked towards London, and also that wealth is being concentrated in very, very certain areas. I think austerity is just completely pointless, and it's self-defeating. Everybody else, you know, understands, like, the Keynesian argument that if you want the economy to grow, give people more money so they put the money back into the economy. And if you look at the poorest people put the most back into the economy. The richest just hoard wealth, and it sits there, it doesn't do anything apart from accumulate and stops, you know, going to the pockets of other people. So
yeah, and it's a funny thing as well, where everything's being sucked into London, but London itself is, because of growth, if you like, it's impossible for everyday people, you know, whether that catch-all term means working class or middle class, really, it's hard for anyone to live in this city, you know? It's frustrating, because I love this city, but it's hard to live in.
I've only lived here 5 years, and the amount of change that I've been here has been incredible. A lot of that is down to housing, just the way that we started treating houses as an asset. People got genuinely obsessed with how much their houses were worth. Housing was one of the only parts of the economy that weren't hit too badly by the recession. It bounced back quite quickly in the southeast. If you look elsewhere, a lot of people are in negative equity. So Northern Ireland, a lot of people have negative equity. Their houses are worth a lot less than they were when they bought them. Same in the North East, same in South Wales to a certain extent. Whereas in the meantime, we've got a lot of very, very rich people, a lot of overseas visitors, treating flats like asset lockers, especially in the centre. And most of what's being built is unbelievably expensive flats. I mean, I went for lunch with a friend earlier, and she's been looking to buy a flat for ages now, and she's about 10, 15 years older than me. She went to the former Haygate estate just to have a look and see what the flats were like. And she came away just half laughing, half crying, because they were selling one-bed flats for £450,000. And that is not a flat that anyone's going to live in. That's a flat that's been deliberately overpriced and then marketed to overseas visitors. Nobody in their right mind is going to buy that flat who lives in Britain, because they know that it's not worth that amount of money. It's tough to live in a one-bed flat for any length of time if you have much stuff. And these are rabbit hutches. A lot of them don't even have like a cupboard to put a Hoover in, because they're not designed to be lived in. They are literally designed to be made to sell at an inflated price. I mean, I went for a walk with my friend Jenny down a place called Bishop's Avenue, which is in North London, and it's the second most expensive street in Britain. The first is in Kensington. And when you walk down it, there are absolutely, I'd say about 60 to 70% of the mansions there are abandoned. Some of them are completely overgrown. You can see like trees growing out of the chimney. The gates are almost hanging off. The Guardian got access about a year ago. They basically just kind of broke into the houses with a photographer, and they saw water pouring through ceilings. They saw fox and owl skeletons everywhere, because the houses had been bought in the late 90s and never ever lived in. So it was mostly Russian and Saudi investors who had bought a bunch of these houses and just kept them forever, because they knew that no matter what happened, they would appreciate value, and if not, they could sell the land.
Right, and this is in the middle of like a massive housing crisis.
Yeah.
This is a situation where there is no real social housing happening.
No.
In fact, what's happening is social housing's being sold.
Yeah. Poor families are being shipped away from all of their families, all of their social kind of support networks, and moved out of London, where they have more chance of getting a job, to the middle of nowhere, where they won't get a job because they can't afford the childcare, because childcare in this country is just obscenely expensive, and they don't have anybody who can offer them free childcare, whereas they would if they stayed where their family was. So you just have these strange kind of ghosts. I feel increasingly that if I walk around London at the weekend, the city's empty, and it didn't used to be. Like, often you go to central London, pubs will be open quite late, but actually people still live quite nearby, whereas now you go out with your friends for some drinks in Soho, and some of your friends have to leave early because they've moved to Zone 5, and everybody else has a much longer trek home, and the pubs are closing earlier and earlier because the pubs are catering to people who work there, not people who live nearby, because nobody lives nearby anymore. If you walk through the city of London, the little bit, during the weekend, it is a ghost town. There aren't even any shops open. You try and find like a corner shop on Saturday, it's open. It's not open because there's nobody there.
Right.
It's this weird ghost thoroughfare.
Right.
So,
but then, I mean, at the same time, I guess London is still doing better than, for some people, it's doing better than anywhere else in the country.
Yeah, jobs-wise it is, but people are commuting more and more. People, also the quality of the jobs they have is very, very, very different to what it was pre-recession. People's wages haven't kept up with growth.
Right.
So people's wages are still at a pre-recession level. The cost of houses gone up, the cost of food's gone up, or the cost of fuel, cost of transport, everything's gone up except wages. So people are staying in London because that's the only place they can get a job, but actually their quality of life has dropped dramatically. Even now, when people say, oh, growth is increasing, the only people who are actually experiencing the growth are people in the upper middle classes and the rich. If you look at the poorest people, benefits are still unbelievably low, sanctions are high, housing costs more and more money. It's very difficult to live in London if you're on benefits now, because your housing benefit is set at a much lower rate than market rate. And in the meantime, your landlord is still charging you, and we're still selling off council housing. Social housing is very, very difficult to get into. We've never seen waiting lists for social housing be this long before, because more and more people are poor.
It's a bleak picture that you're painting, but it's a real picture. That I mean, I guess people are aware of it, but I think it's like, some people are, have enough privilege to not look at all of this stuff and to just kind of like pay no attention. But I mean, it's
also I think a lot of the stigma of poverty has gotten worse during the recession. I think a lot of people, including me, initially thought that the recession might actually level things up a bit, that having a recession might mean that the richest were hardest hit and lost some of their wealth, and it all became a little bit more equal. And in fact, the opposite happened. The gap between rich and poor widened and widened and widened. Poorers became even poorer. And at the same time, you know, austerity measures meant that rather than blame bankers and the financial crisis and politicians that caused it, we ended up blaming the poorest in society for taking any part of public spending. Somehow the villain in all of this became the social safety net.
Right, absolutely. It's been strange to watch. I mean, strange is a mild word for what it is to watch it. I mean, I guess I'm enough removed from it that I can have the luxury of saying strange. But certainly it's been bizarre to see the media turning in on, you know, and communities like... Sure, I have a social worker for a mum and I'm relatively middle class, but like, look, the people I grew up with, those communities are being attacked. And I know those people. They are not the enemies.
Yeah.
And you know, clearly, to a certain extent, you know, you come from a background that is that, I guess. And what the narrative is that people from those backgrounds, just, like people would say about someone like you, you've escaped that background.
Yeah.
But I know that that is a ridiculous sentence to make, because who wants to escape where they come from?
It's such a strange... I mean... Often what happens is people say, oh, you know, people learn about a background. My family I grew up in, my mother and my stepfather, never worked. They were always on benefits. And it's partly because once you, as I mentioned, once you get to the point where you haven't worked for a while, you can't find a job again. You don't have the skills. You apply for a job and they look at your work history and they see it's blank and they think, well, why would I hire this person, especially at their age and that sort of thing. And so people often say, well, you know, if you come from a very, very poor background with no one to university, how did you escape? As if you're going to say, oh, I've got this one weird trick to transcend class boundaries. Well, it doesn't happen like that. It's just a number of things that fall into place that are actually very, very difficult to replicate. And also the idea that this is why I don't like the phrase social mobility very much. The thing is, with social mobility is that in order for other people to do better, other people must do worse.
Right, absolutely. I hate that phrase too.
Yeah, and that's not what really happens. Instead, you get a few outliers who often then turn in on their own class because...
they pull themselves up by their bootstraps and everyone else can too. Yeah, and no, I know a few people like that.
I think a lot of British people have a very, very difficult time accepting how much of their life is down to chance and luck. Instead, it's down to hard work. And I think a lot of that is a Protestant work ethic and feeling proud in what you achieved and putting it all down to your own achievements and that sort of thing. But what I found interesting post-recession, I mean, I've seen a few studies that confirm this, is that the effect of the media and political stigma around poor people is that actually some of the harshest critics of people on benefits are other people on benefits. So if you speak to some people about people on benefits, you say, well, what's your view of people on benefits? And they'll say, well, there's a person across the road and they've never worked, they're lazy, I can tell they don't open their curtains till 10 a.m. and that sort of thing. And then you ask them about themselves and they're like, oh, well, you know, I've worked hard all my life and it's a serious economy and that sort of thing. So poor people increasingly don't see themselves in the same way they view other people. So it's this kind of like internalised self-hatred that...
and it's getting reinforced every day.
And if every day you read a newspaper and it talks about kind of scroungers, you have to justify that to yourself by saying, well, yes, these people exist, but it's not me. And it's relatively easy to, rather than think about what the media motivation is and what political motivation is in that, instead you begin to accept it and think that actually this is true of precariat and the very, very poor working class, but it's not true of me and my family, because I know them and I know it's different. And I think things like Benefit Street and that sort of thing have really, really reinforced that.
Yeah, although, I mean, I found Benefit Street a strange kind of time, because everybody was saying that they were seeing that programme and seeing, like, these figures of hate.
Yeah.
And I was watching that programme and being like, oh, I know people like this, they're nice, and they're like, I was, like, but I think that that's because I've got my own filter through it. So I sort of, like, spent a while trying to work out why this was demonising people, and then I realised that, you know, it's in the way that it's in the kind of the bits in between, like in the way that they frame it. So like, if you look at it with certain eyes, you don't, you know.
I watched it. Eventually, Love Production stopped shipping out the pre-records to us. I was at the Guardian at the time, and I watched it, and I found a lot of the characters quite sympathetic. They had other characters, so a guy who just got out of prison and was started shoplifting again, and they filmed that and showed it. And
yeah, that was when I. That was very questionable.
And so I watched it, and I didn't like the way they framed things, and I could see that a lot of the way they did the narrative made that way on purpose. They would zoom in on certain things and try and look for stereotypes and that sort of thing. I thought a lot of it was ethically unsound in the way they in the way they manipulated and divulged a lot of information about people who, even on camera, admitted they had mental health problems, depression. Some of them had learning difficulties, and I found that very unsavoury. And also, even though I watched it and I saw a lot to be sympathetic about with the characters, as soon as you then look on Twitter, as soon as you then look on the Daily Mail website, the Times, Telegraph, what they saw was the death of humanity.
Complete
villains.
That was it.
So, and you see what you want to take away from it.
Right. I mean, I agree with you about all of the questionable elements of the way that media was made. I mean, it really was made about them rather than with them. It was, you know, people weren't involved in that process. But definitely, I mean, what shocked me was absolutely the way that other people saw people who I just thought, well, those are human beings. I'll relate to them and see. And, you know, there are people from my childhood who absolutely...
My family.
People who kept me safe, like, in a very unsafe time in my life. Like, people who looked after me, who were like the people in Benefit Street. And it frustrated me to sort of see the way that the media was reacting to that, and to hear people who I thought, like, it kind of made me look at my contemporaries, or like people, like, you know, within my wider social networks, of like, well, hang on, I thought you were a nice person, but actually now you're not able to be nice about people from a, you know, who are, there's no difference between you and the people that you're now suddenly hating.
I've seen everyone would turn the TV on now. I just see constant kind of things like this. Immigration Street, we've got one now. Channel 5 and Channel 4 just seem to constantly have programmes on about people's lives on benefits in a way they never do, but the rich. So we had a few programmes recently. One was a Tatler documentary about people who live in Tatler, their lives, what they cover, and that had quite an awestruck tone. It was less mocking, it was more kind of, aren't these people funny and eccentric, isn't that nice, and haven't they got an exciting life? And even the BBC Two documentary series called The Super Rich and Us, I think that had a slightly awestruck tone. It wasn't as critical as it could be, I didn't think. It didn't delve that deep into things, and it just seemed we had this kind of two-layered effect of slightly sycophantic programmes about the rich and their wonderful life and how glorious and kind of inspirational it is, and at the same time we have programmes where you basically put the poorest people in the working class into stocks and then laugh at them for entertainment. And my friend Paul referred to it as Reagan-esque aspirational programming. He said it's the kind of thing you'd see in America back in the day, like, and I see more and more of that. It's quite depressing, but
I mean, that's the thing, I guess all of the topics that you basically write about are pretty depressing subjects. Because of the fact that they have to, I mean, you have to write about these things, you have to shine a light on these on these kind of things that are going on, but at the same time I guess it must be quite, like, you know, wear on you.
It can be. I mean, I've had friends who've reported from war zones, and I always think, yes, okay, fine, I shouldn't whinge. It can be quite emotionally draining, because you spend so much time with people who are in such hard situations, and you have to get to the bottom of their story to tell their story. And it's not just dry stats, it's not just here's an opinion piece, it's a lot of quite in-depth reporting about why we've got into this situation, what people's life is like on benefits, what people's life is like when they flee domestic violence, when they flee torture, when they're asylum seekers.
I've done a lot of work on immigration,
and that's horrific. The immigration system in this country is an absolute travesty, and I mean, I was in. I went to a very, very fancy cocktail party for Moody's once. So Moody's, the credit rating agency, invited a lot of people who worked in housing, property and financial journalists to have drinks with them. So my boss said, please can you go along with a few other colleagues. One of the bankers there was chatting to me and said, oh, what do you write about? And I said, oh, politics and society. And she said, oh, that's exciting, like parties and horse racing and this sort of thing. And I said, oh, no, like more like poverty, inequality, housing. And she just paused and went, oh, sad society. So...
I mean, I guess that's what you're in a unique position, though, as well, because you're writing about poor communities.
Yeah.
But then you're going to rich parties.
Yeah, so yeah. It's such a weird little disconnect. I mean, basically finding yourself in the position of being a misery correspondent, and at the same time, journalism is still... I mean, we're not at the stage in journalism where people go out and have five-hour boozy lunches and come back and knock out a column, but journalism is still a profession. It's still full of people who, for the most part, come from very privileged backgrounds. And because you work in journalism, even if you do write a lot on poverty, there are still a lot of launches to go to, a lot of parties to go to, and that sort of thing. So there's still a sort of quite exciting glamour to it, right, which I find a bit... I used to get a little bit awestruck because I don't come from that world at all, and I suddenly found myself there. But yeah, it is quite interesting sometimes when you hear people at quite affluent parties say that, oh, you know, talk about how much of a hard time they've had in the recession. It's like, well, you know, my mortgage might go up a little bit, and then the next day you're speaking to some homeless people in Oxford who slept rough over Christmas, and I spoke to a guy who'd lost two fingers just from frostbite and that sort of thing. But I think it's good to remind yourself of just how polar the economy is in Britain. We have some incredibly rich people, a lot of them are in London, and at the same time the people cleaning their homes and their offices, people making coffee for them, are paid almost nothing.
Before I ask you the last question I ask everybody, I guess the one question I was going to ask is, was there a moment that you can remember, or was it a gradual process, that you became kind of politically aware, kind of politically active? Because I'm always asking people about when did they, the thing they do, when did that happen in their childhood or whatever. So it seems like I should ask you.
My first political memory is probably of John Major resigning as chair of the Tory party and then getting re-elected. I think I started thinking a bit more about politics and mostly fairness when I was about 14. I just read a bit more and I started thinking about how people were portrayed in the media, and just how kind of some people in my school were relatively affluent, some people weren't. I remember a maths teacher once made me and a lot of other people who lived on our estate sit at the back of the class, and kids from nearby slightly more affluent villages sit at the front, and spent more time working with them than she did with us. And anyway, it blew up in her face, so we got better grades. I think I started thinking about class a lot more then. I didn't really think about feminism, I suppose, until I got to university. But yeah, it was probably around about the age of 14, I started thinking a bit more about class and that sort of thing. I read kind of Road to Wigan Pier, North and South, just a couple more books, and just started thinking about class. And it's probably around about the time the Steelworks closed as well. So I thought about just how great the unemployment was, and how even the people on our streets who did have jobs suddenly didn't, and what that meant. And also just remembering how often the gyro got stopped, how often we didn't have any benefits, just how much of my childhood was spent being hungry or feeling embarrassed because we couldn't afford school trips and that sort of thing. So
I mean, I guess you're like, that's the thing, like some people don't have a choice, they're living politics already. I became sort of politically aware around about the same time, but for very different reasons, and you know, like maybe partly because of the lives I was seeing my friends live, but you know, partly because I think you just around about 14, 15, you start just thinking like a little bit more widely about things that aren't just yourself, don't you?
And also, I mean, I find it quite strange how occasionally I talk to my friends, like older friends, and they say, oh, you know, I remember what it was like in 1997 when Labour came in, and I don't remember that happening at all. I vaguely remember a few photos of Tony and Cherie like shaking hands everybody on their way down the street, everyone cheering. But it wasn't until maybe 2000-2001 I started reading the papers a bit more and just thinking about how a lot of Labour's policies were actually helping in South Wales and very poor areas. Because actually, you know, before Iraq, a lot of the policies did a lot to alleviate poverty. You can see it happen in schools a lot. And then obviously, once I was 14, 15, I suppose when 9/11 happened and I was still in school, that was a big shock. Especially like very quickly, Britain going to war. So the first political thing I think me and a lot of my friends did was march against the Iraq war. We had vigils like against war, like in the centre of town and that sort of thing. So for my kind of generation, so people under the age of 30, that's one of our biggest political memories, just being opposed to war.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess 9/11 happened at the end of my, in the summer, at the end of my first year of uni. So I guess I do have the memory that you're talking about of the 1997 flare getting in. Like for me, that was kind of like a real, like everybody in Cardiff wanted that to happen. You know, the next day in school, all the teachers were so happy. You know, and it didn't last very long. That happens.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's interesting that you say about how those a lot of Labour policies did help. I mean, it was interesting to me, like working in the council, and then like working in the council during the time when the national government changed from Labour to Tory. Suddenly, as being someone who I've not been a supporter of Labour, like when I was 15, I was in militant Labour. That's not being a supporter of Labour at all. But it was like suddenly, oh, hang on, I didn't like their buzzwords, but guess what? Those buzzwords meant something better underneath them than the new buzzwords coming in. I much prefer, you know, equality to income generation. You know, I know which one I want to be representing in the public sector. The last question that I ask everybody is, do you have anything to plug?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to have, there's no requirement. Many people say it is.
I'm writing a book that's out in November. It's about 1% feminism, and it's called Lean Out. So it's a response to Lean In, and that's out with Repeater Books in November. But I have to finish it first, so that's a long way away.
Where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter. They can find me by Googling. I mostly write for The Guardian at the moment, and I might be popping up in your TV to terrify everyone. So
it's been a pleasure getting better acquainted with you.
And you.
Thank you for doing this. I should also say we're recording in a cafe. I'm sure people have noticed, but that's why there's some background sound occasionally. So I really should have said that right at the beginning rather than at the end. But never mind. Sometimes I do things the wrong way around. The last thing I ask my guests to do is to say goodbye to the audience.
Goodbye.
Bye, everyone. You can follow Getting Better Acquainted on Twitter at GBA Podcast. You can like it on Facebook. Subscribe to it pretty much anywhere that podcasts go to hang out with each other on the internet.
Or you can find it on the website www.gettingbetteracquainted.co.uk.
And remember, there are lots of ways to get better acquainted.